April is National Poetry Month. Today on KPR Presents, it's an hour of poetry from Kansas Poets Laureate, past and present. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today's program features Kevin Rabus, Eric McHenry, Wyatt Townley, Karen Miriam Goldberg, and Denise Lowe from a reading sponsored by the Kansas Area Watershed Council. It comes to us courtesy of Angela Elam and New Letters on the Air. We'll start with the current Poet Laureate of Kansas, Kevin Rabus, who lives in Emporia and teaches at Emporia State University.
I'm going to start with some poems that are from the past. This first one is called Fall Up, and it's about kind of an ordinary experience that came to be extraordinary, and that's my theme of my talks that I've been giving across Kansas. So this is Fall Up. Gunkle and I had this big mirror between us, hefting it into the back of his blue pickup truck. Gunkle's real slow, a giant in blue jeans and green Crocs, wearing a white t-shirt with battery acid on it. His glasses are thicker than my thumb. So we grab hold of this monster mirror, and it glints. And we both look into that mirror, noticing the clarity of that blue sky. And those green sycamore leaves reflected so perfectly, it appears you could just dive on into that mirror and sink into the sky. And we think the same thing. You could fall up, Gunkle says, and just keep on falling. Nothing would stop you. And that was the way of it. Gunkle's mind was now my mind, and I was in that mirror falling on up through those white smoke clouds headed towards an orange sun. Gunkle and I stacked box bed springs on top of that mirror and some branches from out front, and I could hear that large mirror crack, but I think Gunkle and I could still see it, that vision of sinking into sky, drowning with only the sun to hold us up. Thanks. As I've been traveling, I've gotten to stop in a lot of towns. My people are from around Lake Wilson, Lucas Luray, Russell area. And this one's set in Stafford, Kansas, another small town. And it's called At the Curtis Cafe. And it's after a Viejo poem that starts out, I will die in Paris on a rainy day, something like that. This is my response to that. What would my death and the afterlife be like for me, perhaps? And it's a little bit zany. When I die, I'll rise in a small town diner with the seat that faces the main street window, and all of the silverware and water glasses and tabletops will shine with afternoon light, and I will know no one who comes in through the front door and sits and eats. We will all watch the street lamps illuminate the uneven brick street and wait for afternoon to pass on into evening, full of shadows, jagged and irregular, the street filling up with darkness in the way coffee fills up a pale coffee cup. I did used to play jazz in Kansas City. I almost paid my rent as a jazz musician for a time. I worked at a jazz archive too, mainly shelving records and finding them for folks. And this one has some of that jazzy stuff in it from gigging out. I still play a little bit. So this is called Nightshirts That Shimmer to Dinner. And when the annulment papers came in the mail, no word from her in years, I knew she must have lived and lived and lived on the blocks I once wandered and walked and knew, danced with the men in the clubs or danced while they played in the background, floated dollar bills across bars to other friends, had talks with musicians, her and her large father, who had enough cash for all a belt and said, yeah, that's some jazz. That's some real jazz we heard tonight. And I turned and left the restaurant once, during my new wife's office party, left the club, noticing him in the back row waiting, talking with the women who wear nightshirts that shimmer to dinner, the club where I'd stopped by to say hey and set in and catch up on my old life, now their life, in the back rows, watching, listening, never knowing why we played for their pay. But in the barely lit hours, in the hours of darkness only neon can light, I too lived hours no one can repeat, in parts of town and rundown corners where music moves in the building as blood moves in the body, and Women can dance however they please, and a man can stand up and know anything his spirit can muster, can know the chord changes with his heart, and know the bar top and the saxophone face, and the drum head and the cymbal dish, and the touch of brushes when they are new, cat paw on Spanish tile quick, delicate as the teardrops, the sensitive get on the heart finger, the ring finger, mine. Thanks. So we'll do something a little bit happier after that. This one is about when I was helping Lisa, who I'm married to, luckily, move her electric piano, and things went amiss. So this is called Lisa's Flying Electric Piano. Her full-size electric piano flew out of my father's pickup truck. I was driving. Somehow the bass detached from the keyboard, and it all went flying into the busy intersection of 47th and Main. No one hit it, and Lisa said, "Let's just throw it into this dumpster," when we had carried it out of the road. "No," I said, "let's take it to your new apartment," and we did. When I turned it on, the power eye glowed red but did not play. The next day I found the volume slider and turned it up, and it played perfectly. Aside from the scrapes from the road on its key cover, it was fine. I practiced tying knots, roping things down, and I dreamt at last of turning corners slow and of a keyboard rising in flight and floating across town, playing a well-known sonata as it flew. Yeah. And that's true. If you get a Roland electric piano, that's the kind. It will take a licking and keep on ticking. We still have it. Some of the keys don't come up anymore, but besides that, it's good. I'll read a newer poem. My sister and I were very, very shy, and so my mother thought the solution to this was to make us into performers. And so she enrolled us in a magic club, and we took lessons to become kid magicians. And this did beat mowing lawns, but it was nerve-wracking. And one of the first places they took us to perform was a jail. And so here we go. This is called Jail Show. Blind Clam takes our group of kid magicians to the county jail, where we will thumb cuff each other and demonstrate escapes, our hands undone, fast as metal clasps can click. "Show me how to do that, kid," says a guy on the inside. "Can't," we say, "it's part of the trick." "Magician's code," he says. "Yes, okay, kid, that I understand." So this is the last one I'll read of mine. I used to play in church praise bands, which are the contemporary praise music of our era. They're beautiful and strange and wonderful. And so I'll read you one from that time in my life. Not that traditional. Band leader Doris says, "The minister says she wants our services to have a more traditional feel." And I know what she means. No drums or drums set to a Sousa march, or worse, tap, tap, tap brushes on a hi-hat, or one big brush circle, swish on snare, sound of the turntable arms cycling, idling on the LP's inner ring, monotony of background click, nothing doing. And so I say traditional. Traditional. You mean like we get a goat and sacrifice it on an altar and raise the burnt offerings to the heavens? And Dora says, not that traditional. Right. I'll introduce Eric McHenry with a poem by him that I really love, an early but goodie, kind of a struggle of the artist poem called Rebuilding Year by Eric McHenry. After Beloit, I went back to the paper and wrote art features for $8 an hour and lived in the gym building on the block between Topeka High with its Gothic tower and the disheveled State House with its green dome of oxidizing copper. I was sorry that I had no view of Old First National. Something obscured it from an inset balcony. I heard it imploding, though, like Kansas Avenue clearing its throat, and saw the gaudy brown dust edifice that went up when it came down. Friday nights I walked into High's home games and sat high in the bleachers and tried to look like a self-knowing new student and tried not to see my teachers and picked out players with familiar names and told them what to do. There's one by Eric McHenry. He's next.
Kevin Rabus, the current Kansas Poet Laureate. He read from several of his 9 books, including All That Jazz and Bird's Horn and Other Poems, and ended with Eric McHenry's Rebuilding Year, published in the New Republic. Eric McHenry was the Kansas Poet Laureate 2015-17. A native of Topeka, he teaches in the Kansas capital at Washburn University, but lives with his wife and 2 children in nearby Lawrence, home of the University of Kansas. His 3 poetry books range from Pot Scrubber Lullabies, winner of the 2007 Kate Tufts Discovery Award, to his 2016 Odd Evening. Here's Eric McHenry.
Thanks, Kevin, for that fantastic reading, and thank you for including a poem of mine in it. Thank you, Kaw Council, and thanks to all my fellow poets laureate who have been such a source of support and inspiration for me. And also, darn you, Kevin, for being so funny. Now I'm realizing mine are going to be really underwhelming after that. Feel free to pretend that these are funny as well. No nose. We like to stand in our front yard sometimes and irritably regard the house, specifically an odd expanse of featureless facade where something, we agree, should go. Some jetty, porch, or portico. Because the synthesizing eye expects it and is bothered by its absence. Our house has no nose. And yet this was the house we chose. Why? We say the neighborhood, the trees are old, the schools are good, etc. And curb appeal is realty, which isn't real. But you suspect the metaphor itself is what we've settled for. We want a house that doesn't meet the beauty standards of its street. A child is going to outgrow her features here, and we don't know what aspect she'll assume or whose, only that she won't get to choose. And when she rubs a little space on the fogged mirror for her face and leans in skeptically, and sees familiar asymmetries, my off-plumb jaw, your errant nose. She needs to be at home in those.
Thank you.
Here's a Lawrence poem. This is sort of a departure for me stylistically. I don't know if it even is a poem. We'll find out, I guess. This is called Tub Thumping. Remember when you asked me for a ride to Lawrence because you wanted to spend Thanksgiving break with your other boyfriend, and I was going that way anyway? This had to be 1992. He was from high school, and you weren't done breaking up with him. You never lied to either of us. You reminded me of that. I walk a lot now, and the other day I looked up and recognized the frat you and your duffel bag disappeared into. I know you have bad memories of here, and not of him, of the half year you spent waiting for grad school, waiting tables, waiting for me to come home from work. But I'd stopped at Centennial Park to play disc golf again and left you waiting for dark, then in the dark, in a town in which you knew no one but me and 2 aggressively Christian couples and that old boyfriend, who was now, of course, a cub reporter for 49 News Source and could be counted on to appear in our apartment at about 5:10. Now I live 2 blocks from Centennial. I used to throw the old discs with my son until last summer when I ruptured one on the tee pad of the 11th hole. That's why I'm walking so much. I can't run. They got the inflammation under control with a couple of cortisone shots, but now the sole of my left foot is permanently numb. You might be thinking, karma. You'd be entitled to. But life isn't obvious, and neither are you. You used to say some petty things, then call them petty, which the petty never do. I came to you directly from my parents, pretty much, which meant I had to learn that love was another thing I had to earn, and that even kindness could be difficult. Thank you. I do hope you've forgiven Lawrence. It's a great town, and I was not its fault. I'm glad you were precisely who you were and not somebody I could just annex. I feel like a lot of things in this poem aren't going to make sense because they're true. We'd broken up for the last time we got into bed together. It was like one of those artificially complex story problems from the GRE. Friend's wedding, you and me and another couple who were still a couple, motel room with a pair of queens to be split three ways among four people. And you were already with the guy you'd marry eventually, but for some reason he wasn't there. Love and Chumbawamba were in the air. And we were both a little drunk, I'm sure. And because it was the only thing to do, we slid familiarly under the covers and slept it off, chastely, not taking care not to face each other, a buffer of trust between us that we must have acquired somewhere. Oh, thank you. Share a few from my book, Odd Evening, and one that I adore by Wyatt Townley, and then I'll let her do her amazing thing. Here's one I don't read so often. It's called At the Baptist Mission. The Old Stone School and Mission that's next to the Kansas Museum of History in Topeka that was built in the 1840s. The first missionary there was Robert Simmerwell, who was my four-greats grandfather. And one of the things that he did was translate portions of the Bible into a phonetic, pronounceable simulacrum of the Potawatomi language, I guess. An interesting and complicated figure, and this is a complicated ancestry that I have and that we all have, I suppose. I was wrangling with all that when I wrote this poem. It's really a poem of the imagination, not so much a poem of history, but the knowledge of that he had done that, and then some quick research and the realization that there are very, very few living speakers of the Potawatomi language that sort of provoked this poem. At the Baptist Mission. In your translation, you relieved the Bible of its possessive case because you knew that ownership had no place in the tribal vernacular, although that isn't true. It's true that they relieved you of your tense and maybe one possessive when you died. They didn't like significant events estranging names from what they signified. According to the 1820 census, no one was here. A bison understands the need for new translations because sense is a property and properties change hands. According to one of the 17 surviving speakers, you were fair and good. She said your honorary name might mean prayed slowly or believed he understood. Finish with a short one here. This is about something that happened when my son was 4 or 5 years old. A seemingly insignificant thing at the time. We were living in Seattle. I was in our house. He was playing in the backyard. I was sort of keeping an eye on him. And at one point he walked by a window and looked in, and we saw each other through the window. And we were only a few feet apart. But there was something odd about that being a mediated encounter. And I wrestled with it for quite a while and eventually ended up with this poem called Apparent. That's one word, apparent, but you're invited to hear it both ways, I suppose. If it had been an open window, you would have kept walking. But because it was sun-puzzled glass you saw me through, you stopped halfway across the yard and squinted through the glare and waved and seemed to wait for something else to happen. And finally, it became apparent that it had already, and that you were being kept from what you'd been about to do by nothing. And you gave me one more gentle wave, I'm here, you're there, and left me in my frame. So Wyatt knows that I have a rare condition found only in poets called villanelle envy. Dylan Thomas wrote Do Not Go Gentle into that good night, and Elizabeth Bishop wrote One Art, and Theodore Retke wrote The Waking, and Auden wrote that one that he kept changing the title of, and Sylvia Plath wrote Mad Girl's Love Song. Nobody is known for more than one villanelle, as far as I know. And Wyatt managed a perfect one, so I'm going to share it with you, and then Wyatt will share some more of her poetry. The Fountain. The fountain rises from a deeper place and thrusts its liquid spear into the air, then turns to fall with death-defying grace. But when we fall, we struggle to save face and make our way with ever greater care. The fountain rises from a deeper place, like the gymnast hurtling into space, who wraps around the trapeze in mid-air, then turns to fall with death-defying grace. The falling and the rising interlace. It's fear that holds us back from going there. The fountain rises from a deeper place. It's only life. Summer will replace what spring has cost. The tree will drop its pear, then turn in fall with death-defying grace. And so we fall into a hard embrace and push our hips together in a prayer. The fountain rises from a deeper place, then turns to fall with death-defying grace. Thanks, everybody.
Eric McHenry, the fifth Poet Laureate of Kansas, who headed up the 2017 Brooks Fest, a Gwendolyn Brooks centennial celebration, another poet born in Topeka, Kansas. He read poems from his 2016 collection, Odd Evening, and ended with The Fountain by Wyatt Townley, Kansas Poet Laureate from 2013 to 15. Her five books include three poetry collections, with another coming out later in 2018. Here's more from her 2012 Kansas notable book, The Afterlife of Trees, which also won the Nelson Poetry Book Award. You're listening to New Letters on the Air, and here's Wyatt Townley.
It's a great honor to be here with you, and I want to thank the Kaw Council and Karen for putting this together, and the Poets Laureate and Eric for such a very fine rendition of my, God, I hope it's not my only villanelle. I've got a bunch. I love them. I'm in love with this form. I'm not going to read any tonight, but you know, I like to prepare thematically for readings. And so before I do a reading, I ask myself, well, what do I need? And I'm thinking pretty much any choice will hit home with others. So I've been needing a through line amid a turbulent, shifting landscape politically, physically, professionally. What's the through line? And for me, that's love and art. It's, in a sense, really the same reflex. And as writers and as readers, we turn to the page in difficult times. I found I had to limit my exposure to the news in the last while to keep afloat and also to keep from drowning and from being, oh, I see a lot of nodding, from being drowned out. If it bleeds, it leads, right? Or worse. So we have to keep asking, what is news? And where is news? The news. Waves broke their stories on the shore, then covered up everything they wrote. As I napped all day in a deck chair, phones rang in empty rooms. The paper lay curled on the table while history was made over and over. The waves rewrote and erased themselves like dreams on waking. All that's left are my 2 feet dripping with news. So we make our own news, and for some of us here, that's a poem. And poems are everywhere around us, just as beauty is everywhere around us. It's point of view, isn't it? And always poetry. This is called The Poem. The poem waits on your pillow and in your shoes each morning. Behind the drapes you draw, it's on the empty swing set that flanks the frozen creek. It's the towel that dries your face. It follows you around the house like a pool toy, from stove to chair and out to the mailbox where nothing has arrived. It bumps up every blessed stair. It's on the phone, which is for you. It's in the coffee you drink and the ink you arrange on the page. in the wood before the paper, the earth that clutched the tree that grew to fill a sky where snow falls onto shapes of things you once made but can't get your arms around anymore, where it also is. There is nowhere it hasn't got to. In the unsold seats and the space between tables, where words mix like smoke between this breath and the next, in the blood that runs around the one block of the body again and again and keeps coming back to knock at the door where someone hands you an envelope. That is also it saying yes. Yes. You familiar with The Course in Miracles? It basically reduces everything to essentially two things, love and fear. So we live in one of two domains. And when we are in love, we have no fear. And when we're feeling fear, we don't have access to love. And so, wow, right? And so behind one fear is, when we're in fear, another fear, another fear. It's pentimento of fear, right? But at the end of fear is something wonderful. The swing. A line branches out between your eyebrows. It is the tree of cares. Climb it and look down. From here, everything looks smaller. This is the place where you fall in the dream, where the tiger enters, where the curtain goes up, and you have on no clothes. Look. There, behind the actor, the tiger, the crack in the drive, another appears on cue. Behind the last fear is an empty swing. I'll finish with this, called Quitting Time. The actors scrub their faces and go home. The cook unties the apron. The crook puts down the gun. Everywhere people are stepping out of their shoes, setting down their backpacks. Briefcases line the cornfields, piles of jackets and ties and upturned high heels. Stop the car. Get out. Get off the phone. You're being called. Empty your hands. When the diving board ends, keep singing. Thanks.
Former Kansas Poet Laureate Wyatt Townley reading Quitting Time from her forthcoming 2018 book, Rewriting the Body.
Today on KPR Presents, it's an hour of poetry with Kansas Poets Laureate, past and present. Coming up, we'll hear more from Wyatt Townley, as well as her predecessors in the post, Karen Miriam Goldberg and Denise Lowe. Today's KPR Presents comes to us courtesy of Angela Elam and New Letters on the Air. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
Some of you know about my double life. I've taught yoga for over 40 years, and motion is a big part of who I am as a former dancer. So Karen and I are very different poets, but we're riding the same wave often. We get turned on by the same stuff, and her beautiful storm book, Chasing Weather, has come out recently. It's just gorgeous. And my book on tornadoes, also with photographs, lies in a drawer where it's been working its magic for about 20 years. So, and yet her new book of yoga poetry has just come out, whereas my book of yoga poetry came out about 20 years ago. So there's a seesaw action here. And so her new book of poetry, which I think is brilliantly titled Following the Curve, because the curve, of course, the curve we're on, the curve we're riding, and the body is made of curves, and our bones are made of curves, whittled by our own motion, just as the earth is whittled by its own astrophysics as we tumble through the sky. So I wanted to read her poem called The Holy. I love the premise of this poem. The holy does not play by our rules. It bypasses designated creeks, preferring high altitudes that make us nauseous. It waits in the soft-eyed blossoms of dogwood. It sails the air, mackerel silvered by a distant sun. It moves like a diagonally landing flock of red-winged blackbirds swooping back up because of what is written in the sky. The holy doesn't have arms or roots we can weed around, although the holy knows how to hold and hold on, rock the rocking chair, jump rock ledge to leaf litter, then vanish, never saying, behold, or alas. The holy inhabits one long note the women sing in the small cabin that condenses our voices into fog, clearing before our very eyes.
Former Kansas Poet Laureate Wyatt Townley reading The Holy from Karen Miriam Goldberg's 2017 book, Following the Curve. We'll hear more from that in just a moment, but first, a poem from Karen's previous poetry collection on tornadoes, tempests, and thunderous skies with photography by Stephen Locke, a 2015 Kansas Notable Book. Here's Karen Miriam Goldberg.
I'm going to start out with a poem from Chasing Weather, the wonderful book Ice Cube Press put out. And this poem is called Being Made of Weather. Being made of weather, you have no idea what you're capable of. The rotation born of two opposing forces can explode down Main Street in any town, any mind. Fight the front moving through? Give up and sleep through the storm? Choices, as if they are choices, when it's time to ask yourself what you're ready to give up and what you can save. Dead photos, living animals, a teacup from great-grandmother, a pink-gray arrowhead found in the rocks along an Ozark lake in 1983 when someone was teaching you to skim stones. Mostly the hand of the child you lead into the cellar. Mostly your own heartbeat, audible as hard breath, which you must protect and give freely as light or water. Always the will to return the moment the storm brings you back out to see what you're truly made of. Lift the fallen branch or plank, bend to call out a name, your whole life waiting for the smallest of motion.
Karen Miriam Goldberg reading from Chasing Weather. We talked about this book in an earlier New Letters on the Air interview and her challenges as the third Kansas Poet Laureate when Governor Sam Brownback eliminated the Kansas Arts Council. Now it's run by Kansas Humanities. The author of 24 books of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, she founded Transformative Language Arts at Goddard College. A breast cancer survivor, she leads a variety of writing workshops for those living with illness and their caretakers, as well as writing and singing retreats with musician Kelly Hunt. Her fifth poetry book shares a publisher with two fellow Kansas Poets Laureate we'll hear later, Denise Lowe and Kevin Rabus. Here's Karen Miriam Goldberg.
Denise and I have little twin books from Spartan Press. They do a pop-up series. Kevin, do they do a book with you too? Okay, triplet books. And mine is Yoga and Embodied Poems, and it's called Following the Curve. So this poem is called The Dead Poets Yoga Class. Don't try to signal Emily Dickinson when she's in child's pose in the back corner. She knows only as a vacant attic. She won't see you in the space between certain capitalized words, long dashes designating what's beyond lines and breath. Feel free to unroll your mat next to Whitman, always chatty beyond expectation or good manners. climbing his prolific butt into downward facing dog as he yaps on behalf of all shining beings. Frost stays at the back of the room, edging his mat away from everyone. Don't try to make eye contact, or he'll sigh and rattle on about the need for fences. Shakespeare goes to the front as if he's the teacher, blocking our view like the sun, coughing too, abruptly and repeatedly when he should be oming, and racing his eyes between clock, characters, contemplating handstands, and the long, elegant neck of the teacher, no matter the gender. T.S. Eliot and E.E. Cummings, the odd couple, pretend they're not comparing their Warrior II poses. Eliot rolls his eyes when Cummings flips into three cartwheels, eventually crashing into all the bolsters. He takes a bow to wild applause. Chaucer hates it when the teacher asks him to model a pose, each breath a long-winded pilgrimage to whatever fresh hell or worn-out notions of nirvana these two bathed humans keep inventing. Milton doesn't show up. Although Byron meanders in halfway through the class, kicks up to one headstand, then collapses on the floor, snoring and smelling like brandy, mud, and perfume. The other romantics, particularly Shelley, pretend they don't know why, although Keats can't help but burst out laughing about how yoga, just like love, is an act of negative capability. Sappho strolls in with HD, rejects using the mat, and insists on removing her gown because yoga, like life, should be done naked. HD smiles enigmatically. When it's time for Shavasana, the dead poets don't stay in corpse pose, but chirp and crow as they lift off their mats to roost elsewhere or fly all night, laughing at us because we don't know how easy it is once you release the weight of words. This next poem is called Healing. I'm a newborn giraffe, my slick legs shaking to standing for the first time. I'm a raw green snake that lost its skin. I'm not a happy camper. I'm a kitten skidding across the floor to the rushing wall. I'm the fog that can't seem to let itself burn into iridescence. Do you see me in a storefront reflection? Do you think of me when you could get up but won't? Do you wonder what could even is, and how you can be so new and broken while the world cries in each crevice to fix it instead? Listen to the exhausted angel straining to reach you, her hand on your shoulder asking the question. Hear the answering kestrel riding the jet stream, all effort, no effort to surrender to the sun, then the moon, each lifting up their reflected and reflecting faces, then bowing toward the dirt where everything begins. The closing poem in this collection came from a conversation with my husband, Ken, who I get my best ideas for poems from. You know, he just thinks up these great things, and I just kind of listen to him and write things down and then run with it, and then come to him and get more stuff to put in the poem. And he said at one point when we were talking about what is yoga, which I really believe is a way, as Wyatt was pointing to, it's a way of coming home to your body. It's a way of being as a verb. Ken said, you know, yoga is all about how your body is a conversation with the world. So your body is a conversation with the world. What are you waiting for from the first air in the first room? While a winter radiator breathed enough warmth for you and your mother, the world was chatting you up. You gasped, you cried, you waved your tiny hands for the ocean you left, and the story laughed itself silly in each cell until it multiplied into millions more, marching to or denying the heart's measured drum. Your body watches the moth on the other side of the screen, drinks the water from the blue glass, and jumps in its sleep. So much dialogue in this continuing tender reckoning of barefoot on gravel. Whippoorwill telling the ears of nightfall. You're always in conversation about how you're not a separate animal, but a talisman of your own place alongside the freeway and the prairie. Each step, another word. Each shrug, another question. For the lightning bug caught on the ceiling. The cat leaping from refrigerator to your shoulder. The wind or its absence evident in the still grasses. The answers may knock you down or have nothing to do with the question you're pacing across the day. Time tells its stories through your body, so yoked to this love that it cannot stop singing.
That's from Following the Curve by Karen Miriam Goldberg, who has a 2018 expansive novel called Miriam's Well. You're listening to New Letters on the Air's Kansas Poets Laureate, Past and Present, from a reading sponsored by the Kansas Area Watershed Council, a nonprofit she helped found with her husband Ken Lassman in 1982. Next, Karen shares a poem by Denise Lowe, who served from 2007 to 2009. Her three dozen books include her memoir from the University of Nebraska Press, The Turtle's Beating Heart, One Family's Story of Lenape Survival, and her newest poetry collection that Karen tells you more about.
It is my very big pleasure to introduce a poem by Denise Lowe, who's been one of my deepest and longest poetry teachers and friends and sister writers, and has helped me see so many ways to follow that wild van of poets to wherever we're supposed to go. And this is the title poem of her new book, A Casino Bestiary, which is a marvelous, marvelous collection. And I was really glad that when I said, can I read the title poem? She said, sure, because I love this poem. A Casino Bestiary. Wolverine triplets zing a match, but one zags away. Add dollars and shake hands with chrome handles. Two yellow coyotes snarl and curl tails, spin again. A shaggy elk bull rises but stumbles downstream. Add quarters and hear silver waterfalls tinkle. Three rabbits disappear and appear and disappear. Jaguar has a cameo role and departs grinning. Add dimes and hear wheel of fortune, ding dong ding. Three honking geese fly in a line, then falter. White-tailed deer leap one after another, add buffalo nickels, buffalo nickels, buffalo nickels, buffalo nickels. Prairie dogs on the screen swivel, watch them vanish. A Casino Bestiary by Denise Lowe.
Hey, hi. Thank you for being with all of us for this wonderful evening. This really is remarkable. I'm going to start with turtles. That is an important animal to the Lenape people. And also in my life, I've always watched turtles. There's so much to learn from what is around us in the natural processes. Turtles are hard to kill. Their hearts keep beating long after separation from their bodies. I met an Arikara woman whose grandmother once gave her a beating heart to swallow along with broth. This was an old ceremony for a woman's coming of age. The woman never forgot the lesson of turtle strength as she felt the sensation of the moving heart in her mouth, throat, stomach, and gut. She still enjoys a long life. Turtles survive because of their strong hearts and also because they can adapt to many environments. English has three categories for turtles: tortoise, a sea dweller, land turtle, and terrapin for freshwater turtles. Delaware language points to yet more niches for turtles. Bands within the turtle clan are bark country, beggar, brave, and snapping. Anyone who fishes muddy inland rivers has stories of great snapping turtles that clamp bait and cannot be removed. I have met people who have lost fingertips. In my early teens, I enjoyed the solitude of fishing in a small lake formed from an oxbow of the Neosho River. This was one of the gifts of a Flint Hills upbringing. I spent hours wandering the lake, marveling at sunfish colors, dragonflies, and placid painted turtles. I caught stringers of panfish and cleaned them for my mother. One day, I tossed in my line beyond the range of snags and watched the bobber tip in the current. Suddenly, an underwater fury attacked the worm. I pulled hard against an unseen surge of power. Finally, I could see the prehistoric beast's razor-sharp talons and beak. I did not know this kind of animal even existed, but I knew I was outmatched. I cut the line. I remember that first snapping turtle as though it were still next to me and its ferocity. I remember my Delaware grandfather's power. Turtles can be both dormant and active, like memory itself. When turtles burrow into mud in the winter, they wait, but they do not die. So. One of the things that happens when one is appointed to be a poet laureate is there are poems that you write for official occasions. And Kathleen Sebelius was my governor. Bless her, wonderful person. She originated the idea for Kansas getting a poet laureate. And she was wanting to have a reception after they had remodeled the legislative chambers. And so she asked me to write a poem to commemorate that. So I went over to Topeka. I looked, okay, it's a dome-shaped ceiling. So I got, okay, you know, so this is what I came up with. Kansas Day, January 25th. Long winter nights, turtles burrow in mud beds while we drive icy roads. They rest heavy shells and sleep. Above them, beavers chink domed lodges and patrol the waterways. Fishing boats hear their slaps. And in this season of hard weather, we gather, sheltered by timbers and masonry walls. We repaint ceilings with star animals and hunters. We remember Ad Astra Per Aspera as sun tilts south. So that was what I came up with. And, you know, all of us poets laureate, when we get together, we sort of trade stories. Can you believe this really happened? And you wouldn't believe what we go through. The rest of that story is that there was a disagreement between Sebelius and the legislature, and she canceled the reception. So I am left with this poem and no place to read it, so.
But we're lucky enough to hear Kansas Day, January 25th, from Denise Lowe's book, Ghost Stories of the New West, From Einstein's Brain to Geronimo's Boots, winner of the 2011 Kansas Notable Book Award, one of three she's won. Born and raised in the Kansas Flint Hills, Denise taught for over 25 years at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, where she still lives. Co-founder of Mammoth Publications with her husband, Tom Wiso, she now teaches at Baker University in Baldwin City. Again, here's Denise Lowe for New Letters on the Air.
One of the characteristics of Kansans is self-deprecation. You always kind of put yourself down and hope people don't really agree with you. But you still put yourself down anyway. So this is my homage to listicles. You know, it's the new internet forum where you have 5 reasons you should read this article or whatever, you know. The dunce of listicles. 1. In a 1970s poetry class, I read 13 ways of looking at a blackbird and begin writing numbered sectioned poems. 2. In 2014, I discover listicle, the word for numbered section trivia like 5 ways to shampoo your poodle. 8 origami folds for trash sacks. A fellow writer tells me she makes a good income teaching how to write listicle workshops. In 2008, I find one of my early books of numbered section poems in a used bookstore inscribed to a frenemy. Every poet in town goes to this bookstore, so this private gesture is a public announcement. This is a brilliant passive-aggressive coup. 4. In 2009, at the same bookstore, I discovered one of my books of poems marked in red ink. In the front leaf, I see this assignment was due March 8th for the advanced poetry class. On the last page is their faint praise, "The image of Wheeling Orion works okay." 5. I do not have enough cash to buy this book and burn it. I decide to let it travel through the time listicle known as the calendar. 6. In 2010, my new book of numbered section poems arrives in the mail. On the first page, I realize the printer cut off the last section. 7. The poem works better without it. 8. In 1984, In 1984, I take my children to the Special Collections Library to find a review of my numbered section poem sequence. The librarian gives the kids free pencils and brings the review. The unsectioned prose praises the typography, handmade paper, and abstract designs derived from quilt patterns, but finds my poems, quote, lackluster. The children use the stubby library pencils to draw sad faces on milk cartons. 9. The same day, the mail carrier brings a rejection letter for a numbered section poem. Rejection always comes in listicles. 10. This one says, quote, "The Tong poets already did what you were attempting, badly. Give it up." I burn the letter. Later, I regret its loss because when I tell the story, no one believes it is true. 11. It is true. 12. In 2015, I realize everything I write is a listicle snaking through the bowel of Mother Wormhole like Stephen Hawking's Arrow of Time, only wriggling forward in E-like motions. Sometimes pages are unnumbered. Sectioned episodes of my existence disappear in the white page beyond all listicles. 13. I wake up in pure air of 1970 and hear blackbirds call my name 13 times.
The Dunce of Listicles, from the 2017 book A Casino Bestiary by Denise Lowe, who followed the first Kansas Poet Laureate, Jonathan Holden, professor emeritus of Kansas State University in Manhattan. His belief in educated and willing readers still sustains the post. You can hear an interview with Jonathan Holden at newletters.org. Now Denise Lowe circles us back to the present.
I have known Kevin Rabus a long time, and I remember listening to Sonny Kenner with him, and I am delighted to read the current Kansas Poet Laureate's poem, Send Word by Radio Wife, from the book Bird's Horn, with an introduction by Dan Jaffe, Coal City Review Press. Send Word by Radio Wave. I hear you now, your voice low and resonant, familiar with the sound of it all. Having spoken, mouth to microphone, on the radio so many days for pay, aware of the radio waves that hit the hill and bounce off water tower and wet road on their way through a soft, dark tunnel to my inner ear. Strike my inner anvil with your consonants and let your vowels fill and resonate on my drum. Puff it up, fill it like a sail, then follow the piping into the fluid that determines balance, motions upward and earthward. Thank you. Kevin Rabus.
This one is about the great guitarist and singer Sonny Kenner. He was a Kansas City jazz person. He kind of claimed the Sunny Side of the Street song, though that was not about him, but he did have a bright personality. And it gets a kind of the bluesiness of that genre that he played, which I thought was kind of a unique kind of actually sexual energy. And I don't go too far into it. It's not erotica. But I wanted to get at the energy of the blues. This is called Sonny Kinner Has His Red Guitar. Sonny Kinner has his red guitar in hand and moves through the melody as if what he wants is for everyone to give and get that long kiss in this room, on this night, in this club, in the levee, where I am dancing with Adrian for the first time, and her hips have got me dancing better than I have ever danced before. And I want to just shimmy on up to her and take her by the waist and lead her on out into the street lamp night and onto a quilted patch blanket in the city grass beneath these tall alders and let our howls be to a new moon, into the city fountains, into the plaza holiday lights that just might flicker and blink on in the middle of summer just for us, our lust flipping that switch, that strand of wire in the bulb heating and glowing for one eyebat wink.
Kevin Rabus, the Kansas Poet Laureate 2017-19, reading the title poem from Sonny Kinner's Red Guitar, one of his 9 books. Listen to more from him with Eric McHenry and Wyatt Townley on our website, newletters.org. Sponsored by the Call Council, this November 2017 reading also featured Denise Lowe and Karen Miriam Goldberg. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Marissa Reddick, Dylan Cramhorn, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.
I'm Kay McIntyre. Many thanks to Angela Elam and New Letters on the Air for permission to broadcast this presentation of Kansas Poets Laureate, past and present. You've been listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Did you know that most KPR Presents are archived on our website? That means that you can listen to them anytime, day or night. So if you missed my recent conversation with filmmaker Kevin Wilmot about his new William Allen White documentary, or my interview with mystery writer and Kansas native Sarah Paretsky, you can find them at kansaspublicradio.org. While you're there, consider making a pledge to financially support the station you turn to for thought-provoking programs and civil conversations. Do your part to help keep locally produced programs like KPR Presents part of our lineup at Kansas Public Radio. Again, our website is kansaspublicradio.org. And thank you for your support.